So yesterday I was suggesting kind of different ideas for mindfulness, using different words. So I was suggesting these two words of watchfulness and availability, kind of way of monitoring your own, you know, what you're doing with the practice, what you're doing with your mind. And words can be very, very, can be analytical, but they also become things like suggestions, like coaching, say, you know, when a coach sees maybe a gymnast or something performing a move in a particular way, and the coach then uses language to help gymnast understand themselves and understand their movement. So that kind of use of language is very important within ourselves. So I would ask you, are you kind to yourself? Because the language of unkindness is not a good coach, right? So, you know, I was also saying how this sense of watchfulness and availability gets lost with preoccupations. We become preoccupied with some fantasy or some judgment or some form of positive or negative, whatever. So if your tendency is to be unkind to yourself, which seems to be endemic in our society, it certainly seems to be across the board, then I suggest that that'll be one of the preoccupations, self-criticism, self-judgment. So to awaken to that, and you just see that's a preoccupation, and then just come back to availability, then perhaps you won't just get into an inner argument, because oftentimes that's the problem with our practice of inner observation, because most of us have really high ideals, we have a real yearning to be peaceful, we don't like our creepy mindsets, right? That we have a tendency to be self-critical rather than just self-observant. A person who isn't self-critical probably wouldn't be here. You know, the kind of total rakish, creepy person out in the universe doesn't come here. So it's a kind of skewed data set, I think. Anyway, that is very important to actually notice that. What kind of preoccupations occupy your mental space? What's the underlying tone or mood of the mind? It's very, very important. Rather than just going into that kind of inner argument that we have, I shouldn't be critical of myself. And, you know, I should just meditate more. You know, just this constant thinking, one condition leading to another kind of thought, and that, and just so if you use this language like watchful, available, it's if I'm thinking about judging myself or I shouldn't be judging myself, I'm not available. But availability doesn't deny the mood. You can know the mood. So, say for me, the last few days I've been feeling restless and irritable. Why? Well, I have some theories, but there it is. Then I ask myself, why not? You know, why shouldn't I feel restless and irritable? What am I, God or something? So, what my desire mind does, it tries to figure it out in order to get rid of it, which is okay, you know, which is like if there's a kind of physical ailment or one that needs to be addressed, or if I believe in it, I indulge in it. So this kind of points to sort of paradox you have in Buddhist ideas. On the one hand, the mood of being irritable, my moral compass says I cannot dump that on other people. Right speech, trying to live in concord, I shouldn't dump that on other people. And I know the consequences of dumping. I just feel guilty and no one talks to me for 3 days. So it's just not profitable on that level. But there's a kind of moral compass we have around these things. So that's the level of what we call social Buddhism, social philosophy, precepts and responsibility and who we are in the world. And so there's non-violence, non-corruption, speech which is harmonious and such like. So that's where we kind of take personal responsibility. But then the other half of the teaching says that this manifestation of mood and thought and so on is not who I really am. It's not me, not mine. So you get this kind of paradox. I am responsible, and yet not me, not mine. And you see, both are true, actually, because that mood, I didn't plan it, honest. I did not think, I did not put it in my diary 4 weeks ago that 2 days before the retreat, I'm going to feel irritable and restless, honest. So it's just a condition which is natural and has come up into consciousness because of various factors. It's a part of nature, just like the sound of the chainsaw is a part of nature. It's natural, you know? And so this kind of paradox is interesting because on one hand, I am responsible, but on the other hand, not me, not mine. And the responsibility is like a kind of reminder that with wrong action and wrong speech, there's going to be consequences which are not going to be peaceful. And if my mind isn't peaceful, then I won't have the foundation to realize nibbana or realize enlightenment or come to the stillness of the mind. So the moral precepts and so on are kind of protection and for both society and for myself. Because if I just follow every mood and dump my moods on everyone, then I'll have so much confusion, then I won't be able to meditate, etc., etc. So it's a foundation. But if I take this as my identity, that I'm someone, I'm a senior monk, you know, I shouldn't have this kind of a mood, I should always love everyone all the time, I couldn't live. You know, I just take the hemlock. I can't take it anymore. Because it's just not impossible. It's not possible to live some kind of a life with the constant kind of emotional configuration. So the second part of the teaching is this sense of this is just the dharma of moods. This is a dharma of a body. It's just the nature of conditioning. And so to come back to this idea of watchfulness and availability, we introduce the language of anicca, dukkha, anatta. And this is the language of letting go. This idea of letting go is quite hard for people to understand because letting go often sounds like not having any kind of feeling. So in my case, restlessness and then irritability, which was coming from that, if I misunderstood the teaching of letting go, then what I do is say, stop being like that. That's not letting go. That's just laying a heavy trip on myself. Stop doing that. Stop being a mood. But if I bring up the language of anicca dukkha anatta, anicca, the way Ajahn Chah would talk, you know, taught it uncertain. This is uncertain. And I don't know about you, if I bring up that language, uncertain, all of a sudden I have a distance and the sense of this is being permanent and me and fixed in time and I, you know, all of that for me falls away and there's watchfulness and availability, letting go. But that doesn't mean I don't feel the mood. I wish it was that easy, but it's not. Because the mood has, you know, it has energy. It has for a certain reason. And why should I always feel happy? Because I want to. And I'm a worthy person, right? But life just doesn't work that way. So then letting go here is, not me, not mine. Uncertain. Don't go there. Unsatisfactory. It's all pointing to the same attitude of returning to the witness and knowing change. So if you observe, well, you like your preoccupations, observe how the stickiness of preoccupations, the sort of obsessiveness of preoccupations, very much wrapped up with me and mine, the sense of self, who I should be, who you should be, you know, self and other, in various kinds of ways. And if one can pop in or have enough mindfulness or centeredness or awareness to say, not me, not mine. Amazing how powerful that can be. The thing is to remember it. So at some point, you know, our obsessive preoccupations or almost obsessive preoccupations or minimal preoccupations, there'll come a time where they'll be interrupted. And that's the time to awake, you know. The mood of the mind is this way. Don't even have to analyze it. Not me, not mine. And so we're always returning to something quite simple, just awareness, presence, watchful, available, this kind of language. Then what I was saying last night in the talk was that really our I think the liberation of the heart comes from desirelessness, non-desire. And so, say this mood of restlessness and irritability, if I am attentive to it, then I'll also be attentive to the fact that I don't want it there. Now, if I stay with that, with a not wanting, this is why we call it practice. If I stay with that, I just feels just restless, just irritable, just this way. Then the desire mind isn't being fed. The desire mind isn't being fed. The mood runs its course, and in the cessation there's peace. And there's a kind of peacefulness which is this sort of indication of what Nibbana is about, or enlightenment, or the deathless, or peace, or stillness. It's a different kind of peace, because it's not a peace which required me running away and getting a distraction. It's not going away from myself, it's like just always staying home in my own heart. Now you can see that takes patience, because the desire mind is not a patient mind, obviously. The desire mind always wants to reorganize things according to some ideal, you know, how I should be, or something more pleasurable, whatever. So, the language of awakening, let's say, put it that way, is not just ideas and concepts. So, like, let's say the teaching of anatta, not self. So many people don't understand that. They say, Buddha says there's no self. You won't find that in the teaching. It's not an absolute position that there is no self. It's just saying that the bodily feelings we have are part of nature. They come and they go. There's no essential self in them. So in this mood of restlessness and irritability, there is no essential viradhammo in that. It's not a permanent person or entity in that. It's just a changing condition in nature. So we say there is no self in that, which is different than saying there's no self at all. Saying there's no self at all, it's a kind of philosophical opinion that someone might have. But Buddhism isn't designed that way. It's designed as a reflective teaching. And as a reflective teaching, I don't have to figure out no self. If you think about no self, it's very confusing. What do you mean no self? You mean I'm not here? I mean, I'm here, this hurts. And you just go on and on like that. But if you use that as a reflective tool, and I think that's the whole point of this teaching, is you bring up this concept or this idea, not me, not mine. You don't try to figure it out, just not me, not mine. See what it does. Or Ajahn Chah, it's uncertain. He used that a lot, mine, uncertain. And that becomes a very, very powerful way of returning to watchfulness and availability. So like if you have a strong opinion about yourself, you know, that you're hopeless or whatever, you know, it's just uncertain. You have a strong opinion about someone else, uncertain. Not you, not mine. Now that's not like a Buddhist position you're taking, you see what I mean? I believe in no self. It doesn't compute for me. But as a kind of coaching tool, as a way of returning to presence, to awareness. It's very powerful, very powerful. And these three take you to the same place, anicca, dukkha, anatta. Uncertainty. Dukkha is that all conditions are subject to birth and death, and all conditions are not the unconditioned. And the Buddha's teaching was that there is an unconditioned peace in consciousness, which can be realized if we stop grasping the conditions, if we stop our endless preoccupations. That requires waiting, that requires tremendous patience, requires non-desire. Because non-desire I like to use the non-language a lot, non-desire, non-becoming. non-anticipation. And it's just for, or even non-desire, even non-effort, no effort. That's a very interesting one. You know, in the beginning, when you know, like if you're sleepy or whatever, then you do all kinds of interesting practices. But after a while, you just get tired of being the doer, I think. No, I do. And then you start to, as the mind gets more still, you put in words like no effort. A very powerful kind of reflection, because then you see the anticipation or the trying or whatever. No effort. Non-becoming. Now you have to figure out your own language. That's more like the language from the texts. But what kind of language would bring you back to this sense of presence, availability, watchfulness? Now, those two, watchfulness and availability, why I think they're a good combination is because watchfulness, we usually are pretty good on that, but our watchfulness is very often conjoined with desire to get or get rid of. We're watching something in order to get some kind of a result or to get rid of something. But that's always a movement towards the future. And you know, in the liberation of the heart, it's always very much in the present moment. So when you just do like, just be available, it seems like nothing. It seems like ho-hum. Okay, I'm available. What now? What's next? And we always want a next. But there is no next. You know, it's just this moment. So trusting in that, just learning to trust in that, then desire starts to come up. I should be doing something. Have I got it right? You know, I should be trying harder, whatever. And that's what you want to notice, this desire in the mind, desire to have or attain. Desire feels this way. Feels this way. And as that desire is not attached to, you don't grasp it, as the desire ceases, you begin to touch the stillness of the mind. So with that mood, like for me, like I was suggesting to people yesterday about trying the lying meditation. I was up at 3 or something early and kind of wanted to sleep longer, but in a way the body didn't want to. So I just did the lying meditation and just watching that same restlessness there again. And irritability, and just seeing, oh, it feels just this way. And really allowing the body to feel that, like his whole body awareness just feels that way. Just be really, really patient, nothing to do, nothing to become. And this is where you can really use language skillfully, just keep popping in, like really skillful language. It's okay, or you stay with it, or nowhere to go, or non-desire. As opposed to language which is self-disparaging. That's why I ask you, are you kind to yourself? Self-disparaging language will take you to where you've always been, suffering. Right? And it's very convincing. Self-disparaging language is very, very convincing. So awaken to that. And then when you awaken to that, come to the body more. So that's what I'll suggest now in this meditation, is a body awareness which is very full. Most of us have done some like sweeping practices, I think, where you go to this part of the body and that part of the body. Those are okay. But sometimes when we do these kind of localized attention on the body, our attention becomes kind of contracted in the eyes, kind of looking for things. So what I'll suggest is a kind of more full body awareness, and where you feel the whole body, and you feel the body rather than conceptualize it. Like, arm or leg or something like that are ideas, but the actual visceral experience of arm or leg is pressure, it's heat, it's vibration, it's energy, whatever you want to call it. And coming to that sense of full body awareness is incredibly helpful for beginning to resolve the moods of the mind. So the mind and body are really one operating system. They're not separate. Because our culture tends to be very, very thought and brain oriented, we tend not to be aware of the body that much. We're aware of the body when it has its extremes of pleasure or pain, but in just the ordinary, we're quite often not aware of it. So what we're doing in kind of like this kind of full body awareness is let the body become conscious. It's a kind of way of thinking about it. Let it become conscious. Give it space to become conscious. And as the body becomes conscious, what you begin to feel. Feel the vibrations or the pressures. And just let it come up that way. And develop an awareness of the body. I mean, I find this helpful. That's what I'm talking about. Develop an awareness of that, of the body, as a kind of abiding that you return to. Something you return to. So you begin to have a different default mechanism from thought. So when we begin training, usually our minds just go to thought. Just like it's like 99% is thinking and 98% is that's useless. It's just the mind goes to thought all the time. So now we're learning to bring attention away from the thinking mind down into the body. Let the body become conscious. Then when you have that in place, kind of good body awareness, then as the moods of the mind come up, the aversions or the fears, you begin to process it through the body. You feel that you know it, it's there. And you don't, because you don't engage in the thinking process, those energies which are kind of contracted begin to just be released through the body, and you begin to have a kind of peacefulness which isn't dependent on you just trying to figure everything out. This takes patience, and it takes this kind of attentiveness to the body and a movement away from thought. Yeah. This constant movement into thought is okay, just the way we are, but if that's the only place that we process life, then we'll always be limited by that. So I think this kind of body awareness is very, kind of very helpful, very important. So let's stretch the legs a bit, and then we'll do some meditation.